Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, big changes at the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association. A new CEO with a data-driven approach is taking the reins. What does this mean for Sullivan County's tourism future and local businesses? We speak with the River Reporter's Liam Mayo live to explain. What does it take to keep a forest healthy? On the next CatCast episode, forester Ryan Trapani shares why letting nature take its course might not be enough and how small interventions can make a big difference. Knowing Newsies, we'll learn about the inspiration for the musical Newsies and the crafting of the original productions for film and stage from the musical's creators. Plus, it's our summer fun drive. Donate now at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Stocks opened mixed today after the Labor Department reported an uptick in inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 130 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in June were up 2.7% from a year ago, which is a larger annual increase than the previous month. Prices rose 0.3% between May and June. Economists say the fingerprints of President Trump's tariffs are visible in the rising cost of some imported goods like clothing, appliances, and toys. The cost of rent, groceries, and electricity were also higher last month, while new and used car prices fell. The rise of inflation leaves investors almost certain the Federal Reserve will hold interest rates steady when policymakers meet later this month. The Fed is determined to prevent runaway prices despite mounting pressure from the White House to lower interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Controversy continues around the Epstein files. The Justice Department and the FBI have walked back earlier statements by President Trump on the campaign trail that there's an Epstein client list. The financier died behind bars accused of sex trafficking minors. NPR Stephen Fowler reports there are conspiracy theories around Epstein, that he blackmailed powerful people, that he was murdered, and that there was a cover-up.
Yesterday, there was a new consensus forming online from people who either said they were moving on and trusting the White House or hinting that there were going to be more shoes to drop sometime in the future. We don't really know if this does anything to hurt Trump's favorability, but it does reiterate the stranglehold Trump has on the shape and direction of the GOP and how hard that'll be to replicate in the future.
Officials said Epstein died by suicide. President Trump says Russia has 50 days to reach an agreement on ending its war with Ukraine. The U.S. is also promising Kyiv Patriot air defense missile systems to be transferred through a sale to NATO countries. Trump is threatening economic penalties on Russia if it doesn't meet his new deadline to end the war. A bipartisan sanctions bill is also in the Senate. Survivors of catastrophic flooding in the Texas Hill Country are honoring the more than 132 people who died over the July 4th weekend. As more bodies are recovered, James Hartley of member station KERA reports that a memorial wall honoring the victims continues to grow.
Adorned with flowers, photographs, and toys, a simple chain link fence in downtown Kerrville has become a gathering place for Central Texans mourning more than 130 people. Geraldine Granado is spending her days volunteering at the memorial. She says the wall has become a place to grieve and find peace, and more people visit every day.
I see that some are adding stuff to the wall, so I think it's very important we do this. It's our way to say goodbye, maybe.
With more than 160 people still missing, Granado says she expects the memorial to keep growing. I'm James Hartley in Kerrville.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. India has ordered its airlines to check fuel control switches on Boeing jets. Amkar Khandekar reports the switches have come under scrutiny after a Boeing 787 jet flown by Air India crashed last month, killing 260 people.
The Indian aviation regulator has ordered all of its airlines to inspect the switches on its Boeing planes within a week. This after a report Indian investigators released over the weekend finding the fuel switches on last month's crashed flight had moved from run position to cutoff shortly after takeoff without the knowledge of its pilots. These switches control fuel supply to the plane engines. The report also said that there would be no action against Boeing at this stage. According to Reuters, Boeing and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration have said in an internal notification that the fuel switch locks are safe. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
The U.S. is imposing a 17% duty on most fresh tomatoes from Mexico, effective immediately. The Florida Tomato Exchange Trade Group says it's a victory for American tomato farmers. Critics, though, say the import tax will make tomatoes cost more. Mexico supplies about 70% of the tomato market in the U.S. This ends a prior agreement on tomatoes from Mexico. Major League Baseball's All-Star Game is tonight at Truist Park in Atlanta. Robot umpires will call the game for the first time. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Murdo, thanks for joining us. Wow, there's a little frog in my throat.
It was raining. It was raining frogs.
It was raining a lot. It was a pretty heavy storm. That is the voice of our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi, who's joining me in the studio. Hi, Val.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. And you're here because, well, one, you got a story coming up later this hour.
Yes.
Knowing Newsies. It's about the musical Newsies, which is going to be at the Forestburg Playhouse. But then also there's this really interesting conversation with the creators of that coming up at Delaware Valley Arts.
Delaware Valley Opera in Lake Huntington at the Arts Nest at 7 p.m. on Thursday.
And it's part of this 50th anniversary festival celebration of the River Reporter. And we're going to talk to Liam Mayo next about a story he's working on. But yes, the River Reporter, one of our great partners here in the area, celebrating their 50th anniversary December. And we're celebrating our 35th anniversary. So you know what keeps these great media publications and radio stations going? Listeners and readers, support from the community. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org is how you can support us right now during our summer fun drive. Val, I don't know if you checked the Wheel of Progress before you came in or not, but
no,
the Wheel
I
of Progress has moved significantly since yesterday. We are now at 61% of our goal, which is amazing. 33,000, just over 33,000 raised for on a goal of 55,000, which we need to meet by Friday.
Okay, so how about a couple of you out there that are listening? If you've never donated before, I'd like to really reach out to you to donate and send us an anniversary present.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Happy anniversary, WJFF Radio Catskill.
I believe the traditional gift for the 35th anniversary is money.
Oh, of course. I know that.
845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. It's not gold or silver, although
we'll take that.
845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Help us get to our goal with our summer fun drive and donate right now during our summer fun drive. Val is going to go man the phones, and so she wants to talk to you and say, hey, wish her a happy anniversary, and she'll take your information as well.
Love to hear your feedback.
It's a great time to get feedback. And in fact, we get a lot of great feedback. And we have some folks online. Andrew, who donated, saying the threat to public media is humongous. Love your local programming. Andrew, you couldn't say it better. It is a big threat. Very excited to see the growth of the board, said Bob, who donated online.
Oh, yes.
Which is great. We have a lot of great new board members who just started and really helping us continue with their stewardship of this station. And Jeffrey online saying, WJFF is my go-to source for news. He also loves Thane Peterson's Living Jazz Show. So great to hear your comments online. But, you know, call Val at 845-482-4141. Tell her in person or also go online, WJFFradio.org. So, Val, we'll see you later this hour.
Yes.
Okay, great. And in the meantime, we're going to pivot now to talk to our friend Liam Mayo over at the River Reporter, because the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association is now entering a new era. After more than two decades of leadership, Roberta Byron Lockwood retired as CEO of the SCVA, and now Michael Martelon, a tourism veteran known for his data-driven strategies, is taking over as CEO.
Marlton's appointment marks not just a change in leadership, but a shift in philosophy a bit, moving from traditional promotional tactics to analytics and countywide outreach. Joining us now, journalist Liam Mayo, who's been following the story for The River Reporter. Hi, Liam.
Hi, Tim.
Oh, we should say happy anniversary to you, too. Happy 50th to The River Reporter, officially in December, but never too early to send our salutations and happy.
Thank you. I have been here for maybe four of those years, so I will accept that on behalf of the wide, broader staff in the organization, who is much more tenured than I am.
Let's talk about this leadership change at the SCVA. Why is that such a significant moment for Sullivan County's tourism industry?
Yeah, it's a hugely significant moment, both for sort of the change happening itself, as you mentioned. Roberta has led the SCVA for over two decades, which is sort of the bulk of the time it's been in existence. And the Sullivan County tourism industry has grown in leaps and bounds since then. We looked sort of at more recent data, but even over the past like 5 or 6 years, in around 2018, the tourism industry brought like $500 million into the county. Fast forward like 5 years later to 2023, and it's bringing like almost $1 billion into the county.
Wow.
So it's a significant time for a shift to happen. And it's a significant shift to happen. Roberta is incredibly tenured in the county. She has this incredible legacy and these incredible relationships built up over decades of doing this work. And she is kind of the person who built the Sullivan County tourism industry into what it is today. She's the person who created that $1 billion industry. So to have that shift happen and to have someone new come in to step into her shoes, I mean, those are huge shoes to fill. Those are $1 billion shoes to fill. And it's just a significant shift in that way. It's a significant industry for a county, and it needs kind of good leadership at the helm for how significant it is to the county.
Yeah, and so let's talk a little bit about the new CEO, Michael Martillon. Let's talk about his approach and background. What stands out to you about that?
Yeah, prior to joining the SCVA, he has served as the CEO of Visit Santa Cruz County in California. Before that, he led the Telluride Tourism Board in Colorado. And as he's come in here, he's trying to sort of carve out his own path. He's emphasized a couple of things in his approach that are going to be different to how the SCVA did it before. He's talked a lot about wanting to include the entire county in the marketing and the promotion that is going on. Previously, the SCVA had sort of paid memberships, and there was an impression, although this was sort of disputed at times by the SCVA itself, that paid members were promoted sort of more strongly than people more broadly in the county. He's declared sort of an end to those paid memberships and has said a lot about how tourism can't just be like, or destination marketing, which is his preferred term for it, can't just be about things to do and places to go. It has to be about lifting up the entire community. So he's talked about inclusion. He's also talked about using big data, which is kind of a scary term, but if he talked about it more, what that just specifically means is understanding the tourism economy in Sullivan County and the tourists who come to Sullivan County in a much more granular way than was possible before. So instead of, say, looking at like general trends for tourism in the county and looking at maybe the overall number of visitors who come to the county or the overall like big $1 billion line item, that's how much money is spent in the county, he's investing in sort of digital tools that can understand like the individual length of a like individual Airbnb's rentals in an individual like hamlet in the county, and can sort of map all of that out across the entire county to show, where the county's peaks are, where its valleys are. And it can, in turn, feed digital marketing to bring people specifically to those areas. So it's a more inclusive approach, but it's also just a more data-driven approach that in some ways fits the kind of AI happy digital happy moment that we are in.
Yeah. Well, and even when he was at the Sullivan County Legislature to introduce himself in June, shortly after he started the job, he described himself as a data geek to the legislature. So really goes into great detail in those numbers. But with his background, it does have a sort of a change in strategy and philosophy. When he came in, he was emphasizing inclusion, as you mentioned, and did paid memberships to the organization. What does that shift mean, and how has the business community responded so far? Because he also sort of froze the grant program that had included grants that had already been agreed to, causing a bit of uncertainty or just some concern questions from the business community.
Yeah, there was kind of that initial uncertainty from the business community. I think there's a level of it that was inevitable given how tenured Roberta was and how much of a shift this is going to be. But then when he came in, he came with an intention to put a pretty big immediate stamp on things and did kind of freeze distribution of a grant program that has already been in place. So funds that were promised to businesses in Sullivan County for events and promotion in the summer season were not going to go out. And there was a lot of initial consternation from businesses because of that. Since then, businesses were able to sort of talk with him and talk with the people involved, and those grants have since been unfrozen. So a little bit of the consternation has sort of died down as people get to know him more, as he gets to know people more, with the grants kind of being opened back up. So immediately, I think there's been a little bit of a softer landing after a rocky couple of weeks. But in a broader sense, him coming in and the stuff with the grant program, it's a change in direction that comes after a rocky couple of years for the SCBA itself, or a couple of years marked by a little bit of politicking.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit more about that. That was some of the funding shifts the SCVA faced in terms of the county legislature kind of tied to some political tensions, I guess.
Yeah, and it gets into legalese a bit, so I'll try to not dwell too much on the details, but the way the SCVA is funded is in large part through the room tax, and that's the tax the county collects on lodgings and Airbnbs and hotels and sort of overnight stays of any kind in the county. By New York state law, 85% of that room tax the county collects has to go to a organization for tourism promotion. The remaining 15% can be used by the county to cover the costs of administering the tax and isn't really relevant to the rest of this. So that's 85% that has to go to a tourism organization. Initially and sort of historically, the county has given that entire 85% or close to it to the SCBA. So the SCBA has been the county's sole promoter, basically. But in the past couple of years, as tourism has boomed in the county, the amount of money the county collects from that tax has also significantly increased from around $2 million in 2020. It's gone up to around $4 million $2 million in 2019. It's gone up to like $4 million projected for this coming year. And in the middle of that process, the former chair of the Sullivan County Legislature, Rob Dougherty, and his legislature rewrote the contract with the SCVA so they didn't have to pay the SCVA that entire portion of the money, that entire 85%. And so a lot of his reasoning for that was sort of feelings of a lack of inclusion for all businesses in the county at the SCVA. A quote from Dougherty at the time says, the contract says they're going to promote the whole county, but if you're only promoting your members, they're not going with that contract. That's the bottom line. So the county started to reserve some of that money away from that 85% and has eventually ended up with, I think, $2.4 million in a county account that hasn't been spent at this time from the amount it reserved. But sort of since that change, a couple of things have happened. Daugherty got canned in the 2023 elections, and the new legislature coming in has kind of changed track and is once again giving the SCBA that full 85% of the tax. So the new legislature is a lot more friendly to the SCBA than Daugherty was. Additionally, the SCBA is currently talking with the county about how to use that additional money that the county reserved. We talked with one of the members of the SCBA board, Mark McLuhan, and he said that the county has, quote, not been overly successful in figuring out a plan to disperse tourism money that doesn't involve the SCBA. So the SCBA and the county have been talking about how to use that money. And a lot of those plans involve Michael Martillon and involve this new, like, data-driven approach that he's bringing in. So in a way, this new approach is potentially helping to settle the relationship between the SCBA and the county that was rocky for a few years there.
Do you get the sense that the trust between the county government and SCBA leadership is being rebuilt now?
I think it's like a bit of a reset. Obviously, like, Roberta had decades of trust and decades of connections with people inside the county. And the fact that there's a new person coming in and a new, entirely new approach, and someone who has kind of made pains to say we're doing things differently here, from sort of freezing the grants and then unfreezing it, but like just basically making the mark to say, hey, things are going to be different now. I think it's just going to have to start from zero with building that trust. And I don't know sort of how the conversations between Michael and sort of county legislatures and county officials have gone, but I, rather than being kind of a sort of gentle transition where someone was brought up from within the organization and was kind of a handpicked successor and could potentially inherit those relationships, this is someone new coming in from the outside who's going to do things differently. So that'll need to be built up again. And that's not to say that Michael will like abandon those relationships, or that the great work that Roberta did, or that anything that like previously existed will be washed away. Just that, like, if there was a need for a bit of a reset, now there's the person in place to do that.
And your reporting is up at theriverreporter.com, a very thorough report on all this, charts and everything there, Liam. Thank you for all of that. Also, before we go, we just want to acknowledge that, again, it's the 50th anniversary of the River Reporter. Later this hour, Valerie Manzi is going to report on a part of the celebrations that are continuing throughout the year, this festival of journalism that's being held for you guys throughout the year with a lot of different events. And this one is related to the musical Newsies, which will be at the Forestburg Playhouse. And there's a special talk about that. More to come on the 50th anniversary, I'm assuming. More great events, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Liam Mayo is journalist at the River Reporter. You can read this story and all of his reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a quick break and back with more, the latest edition of Cat's Cast and how to keep a forest healthy. This is Radio Catskill.
We here at Radio Catskill are facing an uncertain future. You may have heard about the threats to our federal funding, and it's true. Because of actions in Washington, D.C., we may lose a quarter of our annual budget. Congressmen, senators, they're messing with a cherished public resource and pushing stations like ours to the point of crisis. This isn't just a crisis for us, it's a crisis for the whole community. Radio Catskill is a trusted source of emergency alerts, local news, and cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at WJFFradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to voice local concerns. So please, help us out during our summer fund drive. Make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help, too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much.
You can also call us at 845-482-4141. Donate now. He's right, Jason Dole. He knows we're very close to this issue, knowing that there's a threat to our station and all public media across the country, PBS, NPR, all of the PBS and NPR stations throughout the country. Congress considering legislation that could take back already approved federal funding for public media, approved in March, actually. The Senate is taking that up anytime this week, maybe even today. They have until Friday. That's the deadline required by law to make a decision on this rescissions request, is what it's called. Basically, they would, if they pass this package, that would have an immediate effect for stations across the country, including ours. We receive about 25% of our funding from the Congress appropriated money through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so if that money goes away, we're going to have to look at what decisions we make here. You can help us stay strong, stay healthy, stay local with your donation right now during our fund drive. It's our summer fund drive. We need to meet those goals so that if we find ourselves with this budget shortfall, we know at least we're still making the goals that we already set for ourselves with our summer fund drive. 845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. Thanks to Anonymous donating online right now, who says, thanks for your support and for great shows like Electric Mountain and Ambient Barn. Yes, two of the great music shows we have there with some cool DJs and some cool music on those shows. Thank you. We are moving along with our support from listeners like you. 61% of the goal met. We know that listener support is the primary way that we are able to continue going. I mentioned that federal funding, and yes, it is under attack like never before. It's not an insignificant amount, but it is a portion of the budget. The majority of that funding does come from listeners. So your financial support is essential in providing our vital service to the community. Stand with us right now, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And on the latest edition of Cat's Cast, it's a walk in the woods with forester Ryan Trapani of the Catskill Forest Association. Host Brett Berry joins Ryan for a conversation about practical advice, philosophical reflection, and what it really means to care for forest land. And Brett Berry joins us live now. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. And let's talk about this, like keeping a forest healthy. What is a property forest consultation do for folks to keep their forest healthy from foresters like Ryan Trapani of Catskill Forest Association?
Well, I think we have a unique opportunity here in the Catskills because a lot of our properties have forest. And that doesn't mean that it has to be hundreds of acres. They cater mostly to property owners who have less than 30 acres. I have just a few acres myself, and I was a prime candidate for a forest consultation. And this patchwork of private and public lands create the Catskill Forest. So to keep your forest healthy keeps the Catskills healthy. And so they do consultations that involve identifying trees, identifying hazard trees, identifying trees that you might want to give a little more care to, called crop trees, something that you want to hold on to for a few generations, and help with plantings and encouraging wildlife and all kinds of things.
So did you actually have a forest consultation on your property?
I did. I wrapped it right up into my production and used myself as an example.
And you had a few hazard trees, is that right? What is a hazard tree and what happened?
Yeah, this I wasn't expecting. I was, hoping to get some really interesting information about the trees on my property and how to foster a healthier forest. And then I heard a few gasps as he walked closer to the house and discovered that there were a few trees that looked like he wouldn't want them hovering over his home because they were not healthy. Mm-hmm. A few ashes, as you know, ashes are really struggling in the Catskills due to the emerald ash borer. And so there was an ash that was over the house that he recommended we take down pretty much immediately, and a giant maple tree that was split right down the middle. And so this consultation led to some other work, and those trees are no longer here, but we did get quite a bit of firewood out of the deal.
There you go. There's a bonus right there. All right. Well, let's listen to this excerpt of the latest edition of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. It's a Brett Berry with forester Ryan Trapani of the Catskill Forest Association. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you, Tim.
The Catskill Forest Association is a membership-based nonprofit organization that provides forestry education and services to private Catskill landowners in Delaware, Greene, Otsego, Schoharie, Sullivan, and Ulster counties. Member properties comprise about 86,000 acres, but the average individual property size is less than 30 acres. My own property is just 3 acres, about half of which is mixed forest. CFA Director of Forest Services Ryan Trapani joined me for a private consultation and some best practices for stewarding the land.
Yeah, we do about 300 of these consultations throughout the 6 counties of the Catskills, mainly in northern end of Ulster County, northern end of Sullivan, and the eastern end of Delaware County. And it's mainly for people who own less than 30 acres. A lot of them are from the city, just moved here maybe in the last 10 years, but not all. But yeah, I'd say from 0 to 30 acres. And it's nice because we get to go on their property instead of, you know, reading about it or looking at YouTube or something.
The average parcel size in the Catskills is what?
About 17, 18 acres.
So the mix of private and public land here in the Catskills is kind of unique. What can homeowners or what should homeowners do who have the opportunity to live in a place where they have kind of stewardship?
Just by planting certain trees, doing the right cutting here and there in the woods. It could be opening up one fruit tree or a nut tree like an oak tree. Otherwise, if you do nothing, really, that's our whole thing, right? Our whole shtick is the cost of doing nothing. If you do nothing, it's not that we won't have forests. It just won't be the quality. We'll have quantity. We have quantity of forest today. We just don't have the quality.
Yeah, that's something that I've often thought about is, you know, just let it go, let it be wild. But there's no wild anymore, right? Because humans impacted the environment many years ago. So now there's a give and take.
Well, some might argue, like myself, maybe wild is just an urban construct. Maybe there never was wild, right? I mean, because there were Native Americans here and they were messing around and Europeans were doing the same thing. And they were living off of the land in a way that we think of Native Americans. Whatever the case is, I don't know what wild really means anymore. I used to think I did, but humans have always managed things. And, you know, like an apple tree is wild, right? You can find an apple tree that's wild. But can it be better if you prune it? You know, what happens if you leave it alone, the woods around the apple tree? Well, maple trees grow around and they shade it out. So is that better? I don't know.
Tell me a little bit about these consultations, what the benefit is for members of the Catskill Forest Association to take advantage of that, and how often should that occur for the most benefit?
People usually have a consultation once a year. It can be as simple as, you know, they just want us to look at hazardous trees near the house, and they don't really trust anyone else to look at it, or they want, like, what they perceive to be an objective opinion. Or it can be more complicated, and you're going out in the woods, and it's the back 10 or 20 acres, not sure what to do with it. Have been told letting it go is fine. And you could forgive people for thinking that because that's really what we've been taught. I mean, you have the forest preserve surrounding us. That's what the biggest landowner's doing, the state of New York. Why wouldn't you? Right? Who are you? Are you better than the state of New York? A lot of people are like, well, they're doing it. I'll let it go too. And there's ramifications, there's consequences to that as well. But yeah, it can be as simple as just looking at a hazardous tree or assessing it to, you know, what to do with the rest of the property.
Hazard trees weren't even on my radar as we began walking the property, and you already know where that's leading. But I was curious about dead wood and whether I should be tidying it up.
So one thing I'd ask you about specifically is, you know, there's lots of dead wood, stuff that comes down right here, for example, and also just some standing timber. You know, some of it I see woodpeckers using, and I don't want to touch it. How do you determine what to leave and what to pull away to let the other trees have their time?
So most of my job is just talking to people about good old-fashioned sunshine, sunlight. For some reason, when we're out in our gardens or whatever, we understand that our tomatoes need sunshine and stuff. As soon as we go in the woods, I call it amnesia. People forget that trees need sunlight. So certain trees need more light than others. And like fruit and nut trees, your oak, hickory, apple, cherry, black cherry even, they're shade intolerant. They need a lot of light. So it's important to get sunlight on those trees. Trees like maple and yellow birch and American beech and hemlock, they're very shade tolerant. They don't need as much. If something's dead, it's not competing for sunlight. You can leave it. It's good for wildlife. pileated woodpecker might excavate a hole in it, which other animals use from then. There's programs actually out there, we do it for people, we'll create snags in the woods and create dead standing trees because they're good for flying squirrels and everything else. So deadwood's fine. The more the better, really. You know, people are scared of fire, but like that dead tree on the ground that's 6 inches in diameter, that takes a long time to dry out. You need excessive drought for a very long time to dry out material that big.
I also wanted to know about competition between fledgling saplings and how to execute a difficult choice, in this case, between an apple and an oak, sharing the same few inches of ground.
So this little tree here is an apple.
Yeah.
It came up from an old apple that came down about 3 years ago, and then this started to come up, so I just left it because I want an apple there.
Do you know if it was planted or if it was part of an old farm? Was it an old farm?
Probably an old farm, yeah.
Yeah, so it might be coming from the rootstock of it, too. Because even back then, they ordered from catalogs in the 1800s.
So one of them's got to go.
So that's a tough choice. That's a personal preference. I don't know. Probably, I don't know. I might keep the apple right now because it looks like a good-looking tree.
Yeah.
Advice taken. I clipped the oak, much to the young apple's relief.
These have taken root here. These are, I think, quaking aspen.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a pioneer tree. First tree to come in. So we also do like talks on forest forensics, how to tell what happened in your woods by just looking at the trees. Remember I talked about shade tolerances. Well, if you know what trees are the least tolerant of shade, then you can kind of tell when abandonment happened or there was a lot of light. So if you see a lot of aspen in your woods, you know it was a farm or a clearing, however old that tree is. That's it, however old. So there's an aspen right there. That's when it was definitely cleared. You got an apple tree over here. Just for wildlife, if you just cleared around it, get a little more light on that, that would help.
We've got this ash here that's definitely going to come down on its own. Just let it.
Yeah, just let it. Yeah, I wouldn't touch that. No reason to. I've learned to just walk away from trees like that once in a while. You know? Plus, it's good for wildlife. That thing is probably full of things, small mammals and everything else. And it's by the power line is anyway. I wouldn't mess around with it.
Years ago, we planted these, I guess they're spruces. They don't seem to do much around here.
Yeah, people plant them for visual screens. Highly recommend Norway spruce or white fir, but not blue spruce. Blue spruce, don't even bother planting. About 20 years, they start dying from the bottom up.
And that's exactly what ours have been doing. Every year or so, I trim up those dead branches, but the result is a strange parasol-shaped spruce, and I know in my heart it's a lost cause. And then Ryan spotted a tree I didn't know we had and gave some reasoning for weeding out a few others.
Yep, there's a hickory.
Wow.
That's kind of unexpected. That's kind of a rare tree, I would imagine, on your property. I didn't see any others.
For the benefit of this hickory, would you take these aspens out?
Yeah, yeah. Yep. It's just glorified weeding on the ultra-perennial scale. That's all cutting is. So you can either girdle or you can cut down. If it's in your yardscape here, you probably want to cut them down and use them or get rid of them. But if it was in the woods, you can either cut them, leave them on the ground, coarse woody debris for wildlife, you know, or use them for firewood, or you can just girdle them, which is two rings around them if we were in the woods, you know. And that way you get sunlight onto your tree, your crop tree, we call that, the tree you want to keep. That's a lot of what we do is just crop tree management, because landowners get that, oh, the tree I want to keep. Instead of having them look at all the trees to cut, we just get them to look at the trees to keep. Because there's usually far fewer trees that are really nice in quality they want to keep.
Walking through a stand of hemlocks between the house and the creek, Ryan spotted a different species that would turn out to be the first of our hazard trees.
You know, consultations, we'll go in the woods, but a lot of times people have me go start right at the house and look at trees that might be potentially hazardous.
Do you see any?
Are you interested? Or do you want to take chances and roll the dice?
It seems like you're spotting a hazardous tree right now that I don't know about.
Yeah, there's always problems. So it doesn't matter where the sunlight is. A lot of people say, well, the sun's in the south, right, mostly. Even if your house faces north, which it might.
That's north.
Yeah, so it does face north, the opening. So the trees will go towards the north if that's the opening. They're phototropic. So you have a birch over there that's starting to squirrel its way over your roof. So over time, that's going to become more and more of an issue over time.
So this one right in the middle here.
Yeah, the one right in the middle, the little guy. Yep.
And it might also give us a little more light, right?
A little more sunlight. You're going to, these hemlocks are a lost cause, I hate to say it. They look like they're really struggling.
Hemlocks in the Catskills are under several threats, including the woolly adelgid, an invasive insect that feeds on sap and starves the tree of essential nutrients.
Yeah, all right, so these hemlocks right here, they have been infected. They're on the cusp where you could treat those trees. So chemicals are the only way to go for saving these trees at this point. I mean, it's the only way to treat hemlock as it is. So those two and maybe three, you know, are ones that you might want to think about taking a chance and treating. At this point, I can't guarantee they would survive, but they're not too bad. So they should have at least 80% of their crown be healthy. And they're like right around there. Sunlight, too, would matter. There's some research on that. And again, my job's mostly about sunlight. These hemlocks would do better if they had a little more sun. This has to be taken down, this ash tree. That's your priority right here. This should be removed.
That's going to fall in the house.
No, that's really bad.
Yeah.
Actually, you should... I'm going to recommend a guy to take that down.
Okay. Like today.
Yeah, that you should get that one down. I don't like the way that's moving. It's really dead, and they become... I've cut a lot of them down. They get very brittle over time. And the problem with that is, yeah, it's rare that they break at the bottom, but that tree's so close to your house that if the top broke out, it might not be good.
Okay.
There's one behind there, but I don't think it can get through the trees, so...
Oh, man, let me show you that one, because I hear it creaking all the time. And it's got this, I don't know, divot.
It's also touching... It's good. Oh, wow, I was looking at... Well, that's not good. Now you got to take that down. Okay, that's along with the ash tree. You got to definitely take that down. No, this is really... I can't believe this isn't on the ground.
Really?
Look at this. Look at that fracture.
Yeah.
That thing is getting ready to swizzle stick apart. This is more important than the ash.
This consultation's getting more and more expensive.
I know. It is. Tree work, man. That is pretty bad, though. Seriously. You got good insurance?
Insurance aside, Ryan's reaction to this particular maple and a number of ash trees within falling distance of our house motivated a phone call to his recommended tree guy. Just a few days later, the crew arrived and removed those hazard trees, which left us with about 2 cords of firewood. Back in the studio, I asked Ryan Trapani about the wide range of programs and events offered through the Catskill Forest Association.
So events would be like educational, presentations, workshops, demonstrations. So, for example, we're doing a firewood workshop where we're just showing people how to split wood, stack it, how to choose, select trees for firewood. Then we do programs. And programs are things, field services that we actually do for members, and those include our invasive species program, our wildlife habitat management program, where we actually do the work for people, apple tree pruning, apple tree grafting, portable sawmill program, forest bird, which is we'll install owl boxes, kestrel boxes, pileated woodpecker boxes. They have a forest farming program where, you know, do shiitake cultivation, inoculation for people right on their site, right at their house. Also do ginseng, plant ginseng on their forest if they have the right site. We have a tree planting program where we'll plant 2 trees. And it's all these programs are really meant to demonstrate on someone's property on how to do it if they want to do it themselves. Some people do want to do it themselves, some people don't, but whatever the case is, we'll do it. So,
if you could give landowners in the Catskills one or two pieces of advice, what would they be?
I guess to keep an open mind about their forest, that there is a cost of doing nothing. You know, just leaving your forest be, there is a cost to that. And you're always managing for something, even if you're doing nothing. And if you're doing nothing, usually it means that you're managing for only shade-tolerant kind of plants. Also, if you are going to do something, like, say, plant trees, just get the advice of someone. It doesn't have to be Catskill Forest Association. But, man, I mean, I myself, I've made a lot of mistakes planting trees. They plant too deeply. they plant too many, they plant too close, they plant too close to their house, and all that work and effort. And a lot of times it's like, man, if you had just done simple thing like keeping it away from the house or less of them, would have been better.
Who is the Catskill Forest Association for? Who would you recommend become a member and why?
I would say anyone who lives in the Catskills, really. I mean, you don't even have to own land. You don't really have to own anything. But I would say our main demographic is from 1 acre to about 30 acres. And, you know, unlike other organizations, our board is very local. And, you know, they're born, a lot of them are born and raised in Margaretville and Roxbury and Halkettsville. We're also funded by a local foundation. It's not from the city. We also don't receive any government funding. We're not funded by a sawmill. We're not funded by the state of New York. So you have, I think, a unique perspective. I like to always try to question everything. You know, that's, to me, being skeptical and remaining skeptical is what science is all about. So I feel like CFA enables me to kind of do that.
More information at CatskillForest.org. For WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry.
Thanks to Brett for that. Fascinating. It's the full episode available at catscast.com. Valerie Manzi, culture reporter for us here, is in the studio. We're both just listening to that.
What a gift to present this to our listening.
And that's just the excerpt. You can hear the full episode of Brett's Cat's Cast podcast at catscast.com. But it's so fascinating to hear that, and also made me think, like, I need to look at some of the trees on our property. Like, I don't know what some of them are. Some of them are probably invasive. Some of them could go. But I learned a lot in there.
Well, that's what we try to do at WJFF. We try to educate and entertain.
And connect and inspire.
845-482-4141. Send us a 35th anniversary present, please.
Please. 845-482-4141. WJFFradio.org. Let's move over to the entertaining part. Your culture reporter, Valerie Manzi,
yes,
as
I
we
am.
Know you. You have a report here, a conversation with actors and screenwriters Bob Zukier. Did I say
Zukier.
That correctly?
He said just use his first name.
Just call him Bob.
He said just call me Bob.
And Naomi White. They are, well, you tell us who they are real quick. They're the creators of Newsies?
They are the creators of Newsies,
wow,
yes.
Wow, the musical
original,
Newsies.
Original, well, it was a film.
Oh, right, film.
First,
then
and then
film, right.
Got, they consulted on that, and they have quite a resume of films that you will recognize.
All right, let's listen to culture reporter Valerie Manzi's conversation with Bob and Noni. Noni?
I am happy to be welcoming Bob and Noni from California. They're speaking to us by phone, and they are here to talk about their participation in the upcoming River Reporters Festival of Journalism. Now, that kicks off on Thursday the 17th, beginning at 7 p.m., and it's be held at The Nest in Lake Huntington. They've got a lot to talk about, but we're going to start with their connection to this event. Bob and Noni, how did you get involved in participating in an event for our really tiny local newspaper, the River Reporter?
Well, all local news is important, but I went to college with Cynthia Nash, who writes for the River Reporter. And so I had seen some of her articles, really admired her articles. And so she said there was going to be a local production of Newsies the Musical and asked if there was anything we'd be up for doing. And we're always up for helping both any production and certainly local news outlets.
Well, that would be the opening of the performance at Forestburg Playhouse. That's in August.
Right.
And
right,
that's,
right.
I believe, they're calling Newsies Night.
So, oh, wonderful.
That's great.
That's
yeah.
Great.
So
yeah.
Instead, we're participating in the Zoom event on the.
So you've got a lot to tell us about. A lot of our listeners will know you through some of the works you've done, which include the animated versions of Tarzan and Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Lion King. You're both actors and screenwriters, and you're the creators of Newsies.
Yes, we are.
That's right. It was our first baby.
It was our first baby.
And the next movie we worked on was Lion King. We don't have a full screenplay credit on Lion King, but we made contributions, all the
enormous contributions.
The father son stuff in the first act. And but yeah, we had a long and wonderful run with Disney feature animation. It was just brilliant, funny people. So we felt very privileged to do all that. But Newsies was our first baby, and we took it from idea through development and then helped a bit moving it to stage.
Where it won Tony Awards.
Yeah.
I think it won Alan Menken's first Tony and Jack Feldman for score and Christopher Gattelli for choreography,
which was beyond brilliant.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And we've seen it in Milan. We've seen it in London. It has toured. I think it was over 1,000 performances on Broadway.
Broadway, yeah.
So
and we saw Tarzan in Stuttgart.
That's right. There was a stage version of Tarzan. Yeah. So so we've bounced back and forth from acting, writing, theater, back to theater.
No, I'm bouncing back to acting.
I know. We're bouncers.
You're bouncers. Let's bounce back to Newsies. Of course, okay. My first question is, how did you decide on this particular topic to create a film about?
Well, Bob read a sentence, I think, sentence about the Newsboy strike of 1899 in the New York Review of Books. And he just tucked that away. And then a couple months later, he said, well, what do you think of this idea? I said, well, my father was decades older than my mother. I said, well, it's the year my father was born. And we belong to four unions. I said, we have to write this. We have to do it. And it's really what's so amazing about Newsies is it really was the beginning of the end of child labor, where children were losing, limbs in very dangerous working conditions. And the other thing I said to Bob, I said it is the quintessential David and Goliath story. We have to write it.
And you did.
We did.
We
walked on the Disney lot the first time as writers instead of actors, and we pitched it, and they bought it. And they made it.
Tell us a little bit about the strike itself.
What happened was that the newspapers, there were at that time, major cities had many, many newspapers competing fiercely with each other. And they had a field day during the Spanish-American War. They would run multiple editions a day. You've seen in old movies, newsboys and girls yelling extra, extra on the street. Well, that was another edition of the newspaper, say an afternoon edition in addition to the morning one. So the newspapers were doing very well, and the Newsies were the main means of distribution in urban areas. So the newspapers depended on the Newsies to get the issues out. And the Newsies were all independent contractors. They bought the newspapers from the publisher and then sold them or ate what they couldn't sell. And when the Spanish-American War ended, circulation plummeted. There weren't the extras. Suddenly everyone was having to tighten their belts. And Hearst and Pulitzer decided that in one way they could tighten their belts was to raise the price to the Newsies. And the Newsies were very savvy, very well educated.
They were these little entrepreneurs, and a number of them went on to run studios. I mean, so they were real go-getters and intelligent, and they were smart like foxes, and they were
and very attuned to the news, which was heavily about union issues at that time. So
wasn't it kind of the beginning of Yellow News in a way?
Yellow News had already started.
Okay.
So the Newsies decided they weren't going to accept this price hike. So a bunch of them went on strike against those Hearst and Pulitzer papers and shut them down for over 3 weeks. And that strike spread up and down the Eastern Seaboard. The movie and musical only deal with New York City, but it reached down into through Jersey and north, I think, into Rhode Island. It was a really big deal and quite successful, so successful that one consequence was home delivery, because the publishers couldn't afford to have their sole means of distribution be these kids who could shut them down if they wanted to.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that.
It was home delivery, and also the publishers had wanted to have kiosks on street corners, and zoning didn't allow it. But they managed to then push through having those newsstands on the corners that you have seen in New York City ever since.
You know, there was this great character, Mrs. Crybaby, who she did sell papers that way and never made it to the film. I mean, a lot of things from our original script, which we absolutely loved and were jewels, didn't make it to the film, partially because we were rewritten, number one. But really the main thing was that it was turned, our five drafts had source music. So it was the beginning of ragtime, and it was jazz, and it was such an alive musical scene, but it turned into a musical. So
the difference was that they wanted to have what they call a break into song musical, which means you have to make room in the story songs in which in some ways time stops and you start unpacking emotions and also story moments. But so subsequent writers had to make room for all those songs. So you have to lose something.
And they lost a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I still say to this day, and I'll say it on the interview as well, that to me it's the beating heart of those newsies that's carried us through. But to have something, a story from 1899, be so relevant today, so important today, is quite something.
Well, thank you both for creating it and participating in this local event of ours. That's the beginning of a year-long celebration of the River Reporter's 50th birthday.
Yeah, you know, here in Los Angeles, there were a number of newspapers, but some decades ago, even the larger, more successful ones folded, leaving only the Los Angeles Times. However good or bad the Times itself may be, you lose a certain local. What's local is what's most important in many ways, and to lose those eyes on the ground locally is really a tragedy for democracy.
It is. Well, when you think globally and act locally, I mean, it really is. It's the only way we can act. I mean, if people have resources, they can give money, but, you know.
But so public radio has replaced some of what was lost in that, in the local print media. But that's under threat now, too. So we all need to step up and further support our local public radio stations.
Well,
because they're a crucial link in telling us what's going on.
Well, thank you so much for doing your part in participating in this event and taking the time to share your thoughts about it with us.
It's
a privilege.
It really is. It's true.
You are welcome.
And a privilege.
It is our privilege to talk to you, too. Thank you.
Culture reporter Valerie Manzi, a little mutual admiration society
going on
there with your friends Bob and Noni.
Know.
That's nice. You're going Hollywood on us, Val.
Yes, well, I'm going to take off on privilege now. You have the privilege to be listening to WJFF, brought you this incredible story about the forest and trees.
Yep. And before that, River Reporter's Liam Mayo talking about the new SCVA leadership. You talking about the great culture in our area with this new take, not new take, an interesting take on the behind the scenes, the people that created that musical right here. They're going to be talking about that.
Yes. So, give us a call, 845-482-4141 or online at wjffradio.org. And a special shout out to those of you who haven't donated yet.
Donate now.
Or haven't ever donated.
Donate now.
Do it.
845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Val, thank you so much. We're going to get into On Point next. You're listening to WJFF Jeffersonville Radio Catskill. Sunshine and clouds mixed today with a high of 83, dry today. It's 11 o'clock.